Hello, 1088 Nation. I'm Ellis Maxwell, your host. Thank you for tuning in to the podcast. I want to give a really big shout out to the Daybreak community of South Jordan, Utah, and the staff there for having me as a guest for their Pillar Talks. It was super awesome. Thank you, and I can't wait for the next event. What a great community, by the way. If you're ever looking for a place, South Jordan, Utah, the Daybreak community is an awesome place. I'll be hosting my own event in the next 4 to 6 weeks in Salt Lake. I'll be heavily referencing the Powell case while identifying key signs of relationship abuse and domestic violence, followed with a Q&A. So follow me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. All these links can be discovered on my website, ellismaxwell.com. Yeah, buddy. Gosh, I love doing these podcasts, and I really appreciate you all listening in. Real big quick note here. If you or someone you know is involved in a toxic relationship involving relationship abuse or domestic violence, Shield Balance, LLC, is only a call away or an email click away. We can assess your situation, help you develop a plan, provide you the resources and direction that you need to begin an escape. Yeah, an escape. Shield Balance will even assist you in escaping a volatile relationship if needed. So between Shield Balance and our awesome victim advocates that we have throughout the communities and our police departments and other resources, you'll have all the support that you need in these situations and to get out. All right, shieldbalance.com. And now, folks, let's get the show on the road, the Ellis Maxwell 1088 podcast experience. And now, 1088 Nation, I deliver to you number 4. Our guest today is Mike, former police officer who retired early from a Utah municipal agency. Let's get him on the air and hear his story. Thank you again for listening. Please, and always, share, repost, retweet 1088 podcast to your friends, family, coworkers, and associates. Mike, what is up?
Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Holy cow. A little bit of a technology glitch there.
Yeah. That was crazy, man. That was crazy. Everything sounds good now, though.
I think it's cold weather here.
Yeah, dude, it is, man. Like I was talking to you earlier, I was freaking in Tucson, 90 degrees. I come home and there's 7 inches of snow and it's like winter, you know? Horrible.
We got to treat you right, man. Got to treat you right.
So, what have you been up to, man? When was it that you? What year was it that you left police work?
So, I left in February 2004. I had just hit my 10-year.
Oh wow! Okay. Oh wow! That was a minute ago, dude.
Yeah, it was. It seemed honestly, dude. It seems like it was a lifetime away for a lot of reasons, but. You know, when you bleed blue, you're always there. So I still keep quite connected.
Yeah. No, you are totally. And you know what's crazy is, so when you left in 04, let's see, I just barely came over to the police department in 2001.
So, oh, you did,
remember? Because I was doing the whole code enforcement thing for a minute, and you was doing COP. So that's where we first connected.
Yeah, because I remember standing out in some field one time doing an abatement and talking to you about doing an interview.
Yeah.
And you were getting frustrated. So, yeah, it's been some time, man.
I get frustrated. I got frustrated.
Maybe that's an understatement.
Dude, I hate that job, man. I'll tell you what, you want to talk about a stressful job, man. That code enforcement shit was bad. That gave me more stress than police work any day.
Good times, though.
Yeah, it was. So 2004, so you did 10 years. That's good, man. That's good. What aspect of police work do you miss most?
You know, my wife and I were talking about that the other day, and you know, law enforcement for me was, I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. You know, I had started, in essence, started my career back when I was in high school, and I had actually got onto the Murray City Police Department with their cadet program. And it's kind of funny with that program, as a whole bunch of us LDS kids going to Murray High School, and nobody drank, nobody smoked, nobody drank coffee. And I was the only person that did all three. And just going along, trying to get as much experience as I could without being a real cop, and just decided that I had a bug for it, and decided that I wanted to try and do that once I got out of high school. And one thing led to another, and worked at a couple of departments as a reserve officer. And then I did a stint in prison for 7 months out there at Draper. Mm-hmm. And I always love saying that way, because people think that I actually served time there. But but yes, and that's when about 7 months later, West Valley got in touch with me and said that they wanted to hire me. So,
right, dude, how was that? How was the prison, man?
You know, I don't know if there's anybody on the podcast at all that works from the prison. You're talking over 20 years ago, but that whole idea of you're not going to take me back to prison, I would never go back and work at the state prison. In regards to being a good learning experience, it was awesome. Because, you know, ultimately you're locked in 24 hours or whatever your shift is, with inmates, and you really learn how to deal with inmates, that are cooped up and wanting to fight and are sometimes aggressive and very manipulative. And you really learn how to deal with people. And I think that experience helped me on the street. But, yeah, as far as going to the prison, I wouldn't want to go back.
I mean, you're locked up essentially with these knuckleheads, man, all day, your entire shift. And I can see that point there that you just mentioned, that you learn a lot as far as communication.
You do.
And picking up on behaviors and cues. So that would be super beneficial on the road.
I can say that in 10 years in law enforcement, you know, obviously I had to go hands-on with people, but I never had to use force to do it. And, you know, I credit that to being able to talk somebody into handcuffs. That's what I learned at the prison. You know, everybody told me you need to talk somebody into handcuffs as much as possible. Because when there's a fight, someone's going to get hurt and you don't want it to be you. So, you know, working at the prison really taught me that. And it taught me that some scumbags are in there. In fact, most scumbags are in there. There are some people out there that just screwed up, you know, and so it brought a little bit of a respect out onto the street, so that I could talk to people and say, hey, you know what?
Yeah.
I'm going to get arrested, yeah, you know, but things are going to move forward for you. So,
yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, very good. Very good experience. I couldn't do that job. There's no way I could work the jail or the prison for a career. I don't know if I could even do a year. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, right on. So when you got on with West Valley, did you do SWAT over there?
I did.
Yeah,
I was on SWAT for 4 years.
Yeah. So you would have probably been a stellar negotiator, man. But you wanted to play SWAT and sit and hurry and wait while I sat and did negotiations.
That's exactly right, man. You guys do all the talking, we just do the action.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
No, that was always one of the things that we would talk about, like you know, one of the other officers that you and I worked with, we were up on top of a a warehouse building in a sniper roost, and talking about how, you know, the negotiations were going, and we sat there and we froze to death for about 3.5, 4 hours while negotiators sat there and tried to talk the guy out. And he finally came out. We ended up tanking his butt and taking him to jail. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, cause I did negotiations. I think, I think I went into negotiations in 2002 or 2003. And I basically stayed there until I retired. And yeah, man, I'd be in there negotiating. And while I'm negotiating, I'm thinking of, you know, if it's cold outside, I'm thinking, all right, whoever's, you know, sitting sniper or immediate action team, man, it's got to be cold. That would suck.
Well, you got a heart, man. You could have brought us some donuts or something.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, that was those are always good times. I mean, for SWAT, I mean, that's not always the situation, right? I mean, you guys, if you have a barricade or a hostage situation, yeah, that's the scenario. But outside of that, that's where the fun is going in and executing the search warrants and everything else.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it was something that if I could have done SWAT as just a primary assignment, you know, there's the brotherhood and sisterhood of police work is incredible. And then you hone that into a team. It's time that I was on the team. I think we had 23 people combined between us and South Salt Lake and just to take that team of all minded, you know, very, very assertive, very ready to protect and serve type of individuals, highly trained. The brotherhood was incredible. You know, there's still people that I talk from the team to this day, and and they're my brothers. Yeah. So
yeah, the camaraderie being on the SWAT team is completely different than any other assignment in police work, I think.
I think it is, because I think that I think that you have to be so close that you know when the first, you know, the guy in front of you, which way he's going to go and how he's going to respond. And you only get that through training and hanging out in a SWAT truck and telling dirty jokes and not eating and all that stuff that goes along with search warrants. You build that camaraderie where you are that close, and it's essential in that type of an assignment. Yeah. So.
Well, and you've got to have that trust too, right? I mean, you're freaking going into this house, and you may have an idea of how many people are in there, where they may or may not be, but you're going into this house, and who's to say that, yeah, they're not going to fight back and shoot back. And so, you know, absolutely, it's a very, very dangerous situation. And you don't see it a lot with the agencies across the nation where SWAT goes in and a member gets shot. You don't see it a lot. And I think a lot of it all has to do with that camaraderie and that training and, being switched on and having that trust with your members.
Yeah. Yeah. The only time that I felt real dangerous was in the SWAT truck with Lauren. So, and that's only because of his flatulence. So hopefully he's on the podcast and he can hear that, because he'll respect that quite a bit.
Right on, man. Well, what other assignments? So, we talked about you worked, COP. What else did you do with the police department?
So, obviously it was patrol, and then, went into COP. And while I was on COP, then that's when I got onto the SWAT team as well as firearm staff. And then from there, 2 years into the SWAT team, then I got onto the detective division in property crimes. And it was actually detective division where I retired out. So.
How many years were you in investigations?
That's a good question. I want to say 2 years, maybe 3 years.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So in your, through your career, Let's talk about some of the things like that you've seen throughout your career, whether if it was in patrol or whether if it was investigations or a special assignment. Like, I mean, these people, they're watching stuff on TV all the time, right? The community loves crime TV, and I don't even know. The only one that comes to my mind is Chicago PD, but I know there's like tons of them out there. I don't watch them. I don't care to watch them. But the realism of television versus what we've experienced on the road. I mean, what kind of experiences did you have on the road, and how did that have an impact on you as a person, or your career, or your family?
Well, so I was only there for 10 years. It's kind of interesting because I had a really good friend of mine when I started. He had worked over at Sandy PD, and in the first 3 months of working with West Valley, I had seen more deaths and more domestic violence than he had seen in a year.
Yeah, I believe it.
And I think that was the demographic of just the area that you and I worked in. But the difference between Hollywood and real life is that a lot of it, everybody's heard that 99% boredom intermixed with 1% sheer terror, and I think that that's really true in law enforcement, because a lot of what you see on Hollywood is something that may happen in one person's, one time in one person's 20-year career, and it never falls in together like it does in 1 hour
Yeah.
on the TV. And you know
Yeah.
that. I mean, hell, you worked a call for several years. So, the reality of going from a found bicycle call to 20 minutes later being dispatched on a shooting is reality. And and in that kind of work, both of those calls can get you killed, depending on the circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very true.
A lot of people, wondered why I got out of law enforcement as early as I did, and really, a lot of it had to do with the types of calls that I did go on, and the PTSD that followed those calls and followed me throughout most of my career until I actually got out and found somebody that could help deal with that.
Yeah. Was that Beal?
Yeah, actually, it was. Yep, that sure was.
Now, was it accumulation of events that you were exposed to, or was there one specific traumatic event that you were exposed to that had probably the bigger impact?
It was actually two of them, Ellis. It was something that when I got into law enforcement, I'd already decided that there was a possibility of having to take someone's life, and as much as I didn't want to, I was resolute in that. The types of crimes that I saw, especially on adults, is, some were bad, some were horrific, and some were, they were just normal things of life. But the things that really got me were situations with kids. And see, I'd been there, got hired in 94, so 97, I think it was 97 or 98, I got dispatched on to a lost child call, and the child was 3 years old, middle of July. And so I get there, it's about an hour, maybe hour and a half before the end of my shift, and met with the father and the mother, both of which were pretty distraught. She obviously was, and was crying and whatnot because the child was missing. And
Yeah. It cut out again.
You there, buddy?
Got it. Yep. You're good.
So I got to the house, talked to the parents, and they said that they had searched the house and searched the yard, couldn't find their kid. And so I went into the house and did that preliminary look and didn't see him. So I jumped back into my car.
Mm-hmm.
And they had already had the neighborhood full of neighbors looking for the kid. And I said, well, keep doing that. I'm going to drive further through the neighborhood and see if I could see him walking down the road. About 15 minutes later, as I was heading back towards the apartment to see if they had found him yet, mm-hmm. All the neighbors started running to my car, and they said that they had found him and that he was dead. And I immediately called dispatch, got more units on their way, and went over to the property. And they had found him actually in one of the neighbors' cars. Long story short, the 5-year-old brother and the 3-year-olds got into the car and were pretending to drive the car. And the 5-year-old got hot and decided to get out. Well, the 3-year-old couldn't, and ended up, you know, because of the extreme temperatures, ended up dying in the car and basically cooking to death. So that one really messed me up. I get emotional just thinking about it right now.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, who wouldn't, right? 3 years old,
so,
and you know, poor little guy, he doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, they found him curled up in the back seat, and as near as we could tell is that he got so hot that he just collapsed on the back seat and just continued to overheat. When medical got there, they did CPR on the child, even though he was so hot. When I initially touched him to start CPR, he was so hot that my hand actually just got a reflex came off of his chest because he was so hot. And they got him, they took him to the emergency room as a way to let the parents know, hey, we're doing something to try and save your life, save your child's life, even though he was gone.
Right.
And his internal core temperature was still 118 once they got him to the hospital.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, it's weird, man. It's weird, brother, because that happened 97, like I said, 97, 98, and I'm still kind of emotional, and I've dealt with this crap, you know, over the last 15 years, I've really worked on this and to compartmentalize, and it still is emotional.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, and it's going to be for anybody, especially doing our line of work. I mean, we get into this line of work to help people. Right. And yeah. So right there, I mean, you know, 99.9% of us that go into this career are already sympathetic and empathetic. We care about people. We care about their well-being.
Right.
So, yeah, naturally, you know, you come across a horrific situation such as this, where this little guy didn't have, you know, he just doesn't have the knowledge. He's 3 years old, man. He's just getting inside this car to play. And, you know, it's on the parents, man. I mean, I hate to say that put it on the parents, but, you know, whoever's car that was, it should have been locked. These
yep,
three and 5 year olds probably shouldn't have been running around the apartment complex.
Yep. Yeah. You start, you know, as a police officer and I had my oldest had just, she was probably what she was, 6 months old. So, you know, 6 months into a parental situation, you're already asking questions. Well, where were the parents? Why were these kids out playing by themselves in the neighborhood that they were in? You know, there's just a whole lot of questions that come into play. And then you start thinking about how simple something like that can happen. You know, and as for myself personally, you know, start thinking of, well, hell, you know, would I have been able to save his life had I checked the car first? You know, and instead of going into the neighborhood and looking for the child in the neighborhood, you know, so there's a lot of regrets. There's a lot of remorse. There's a lot of questions that come up in the cop's mind as well, mm-hmm. as to something that I did that contributed to this.
Well, you know,
So.
and I don't know. I mean, that's where I disagree and say that your actions or lack of actions are a contributor, right? You don't know. You get called on this call of a missing child. I mean, naturally, our very first thing to do is always check the home because 90% of the time the kids are in the home, they're hiding under the bed, they're hiding in a closet, right?
Right.
So we always clear the house first because even though the parents tell us, oh, we've already looked, we've already looked. I don't know how many times I would go into a house and I would still find the kids in the house.
Exactly.
So, you know, you can't, no, I don't believe any officer can put that on themselves and be like, you know, but it's natural. It's natural that we do that. We, you know, like you said, if I would have checked the car first, but who's to say that you would have known to check the car, right? I mean,
Yeah. It's completely natural, but it's not the cop's fault,
right.
you know, and I think that that's what leads to so many officers having challenges emotionally and mentally throughout their career. You know, for me, I kept swallowing on that and kind of pushing it aside. You know, the brain, the smarts of me was saying, no, hey, you know, I did everything that I could. And yet at the end of the day, he still wasn't there. I didn't deal with that very well, and you know, ultimately, that honestly, I think that that particular call started my relationship problems with my wife, which ultimately ended in divorce. You know, and following that with some other things that had occurred later on in my career, you know, those types of things contributed to that quite a bit.
Yeah, because you're probably you know, not yourself. I mean, w when this
Not at
when this
all.
cla when this case took place and you went out on this call, was it, do you remember, was it the beginning of your work week, middle of the work week, your last day of the work week?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, you know, you remember traumatic situations like that, like it's yesterday. It was the last day of my work week, and I remember my then wife. She was I had gotten a hold of her and I said, hey, I'm going to be late. I can't really go into things, but this is kind of what's going on. And she and I and her parents had a basically a date to go and see the races out at Rocky Mountain. And by the time I was done with that call, I was not in any mood whatsoever to go out to the races. And it set off a cacophony of crazy things that could only have happened just because of Murphy's Law. But you know, ultimately, she didn't know all the details, and she thought that I avoided the races because she didn't want me to be with her parents. And it's like, no, I'm going through an emotional crisis right now, and I'm not knowing. You know, I don't know how to deal with it.
Right.
Yeah. So it was it really affected a lot of things immediately and long term.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't, that I can't even imagine, like, going out on this call and then getting done with your getting, you know, wrapping up with that call, going home and okay, let's go have beers and go to the race. Like, as if it's just another day. That'd be pretty rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, the kids are always really challenging, especially if you have children. So, like you had mentioned earlier, you know, this little tyke was 3 years old, and in yours was what, did you say 9 months?
She was six
Six
months
months
old
old.
the other time.
So, I mean, you know, pretty close there, and you know, so it makes it even more challenging. Makes it really, really challenging.
Well, the one the one situation that ended my career again was involving child, and I don't know, I can't remember if you went out there or not. I was just in the area, so I went and held the scene until a couple more officers got there. But the 9-year-old brother and the 2-year-old's brother, they woke up in the morning and they wanted to play cops and robbers. Well, mom, she was a security guard. She had fallen asleep on the couch. She had left her gun up on the bookcase. And the 9-year-old got the real gun and the 2-year-old got the fake gun. And the 9-year-old proceeded to, shoot his younger brother in the face.
Oh, shit.
And that one was the coup de grace for my career. I had at that time, my son was 2 years old. I left the scene. I went directly back to the department, grabbed my stuff from my desk, talked to the secretary on the way out. She said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going home, but let Sergeant know that I'm going home." I went and picked up my son. And, on the scene, I saw this child that, I mean, he looked like my son. And, I went and picked up my son from daycare and I took him home. I called my wife and I said, "Hey, get home. This is what just happened." And my son, I would not put him down. And he had actually clawed my arms so much trying to get away from me that I had scars for 3 years after.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't until my wife got home that I put him down, because then he was safe. And the sergeant contacted me at home and said, "Hey, I just heard, what's going on? Do I need to get out there?" And I said, I told him no. And then the following week, I had made the decision that I was going to quit in February.
Wow. But how responsive was the agency?
So as far as the agency, it wasn't very responsive at all. My direct supervisor was, and I appreciated that quite a bit. I knew my time was done though. But you're dealing with a community that, 10% of the police departments in this country have a suicide prevention program. Did you know that?
Yeah, I know it's really, really low. And, they don't really, they offer the employee assistant program.
Yep.
But EAP. Yeah, but that program isn't worth shit.
It's not. It's not. It's frustrating. It's sad. It's, you're dealing with a community of first responders that they're, in the last 3 years that, we've lost more law enforcement officers for the last 3 years to suicide, to PTSD, than we have law enforcement officers in the line of duty. And that's, I really contribute that to the fact that departments just don't want to talk about it and they don't know how to deal with it, and I hate to think that they just choose not to do anything about it, but it's reality.
No, it is. And I think right now where we're at in March, well, we're going to go into April here shortly, and I think we're at the brink of 60 suicides just in law enforcement for this year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you and I were talking earlier, you said, "Hey, can I use your name? Do you want to keep anonymous?" I'm so passionate about this. As we were talking earlier before the podcast, my wife told me, she says, "Now don't be so passionate on the podcast because you're driving me crazy." But the reality of it is that the PTSD stuff and the resulting marriage stuff and all of that stuff that found me in 2 suicide attempts. I was interrupted on both of them. That's something that a lot of people don't know about me. One of mine and your brothers at the police department, he even sat down in a park with me one time, and I sat there and literally cried for an hour. Right. To him. The sad part about law enforcement is there's an enigma that you've got to be the warrior. I mean, we've been trained to be the warrior. We're the ones that resolve the issue. When things turn to shit, who do you call? Well, you call the cops.
Right.
And yet there's a time the cops need some support too. And the cops, police officers just aren't getting that support. And you know, I think over, well, since what, 2016, every year since 2016, we've hit record numbers of suicides. We're still at 10% of the departments that have any kind of suicide awareness or suicide prevention, EAP, like you said. You know, they're a bunch of social workers, and I know that they mean well, but they're not trained, and they're not seeing the stuff that first responders see, and they're not equipped or ready to deal with that kind of pain, that kind of trauma, the images that they have in their minds that they deal with every single day. And they don't know how to take a law enforcement officer and compartmentalize the trauma so that they can continue living a successful life without pushing everybody away, without attempting suicide, without getting addicted to drugs or alcohol. They don't know how to do that. You need to take somebody like Bill, who does know, and get that compartmentalized so that the officer can deal with it.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And I mean, it is what it boils down to, in my opinion, is you have to find the right professional to help you. And 9 times out of 10, well, I take that back. I'd say 75% of the time, it's going to have to be a licensed psychologist. Or you can get somebody that's got a master's degree that has focused a lot on, police traumatic events. And there's a few of those guys out there, but you've really got to find that right individual that is familiar with the career, familiar with all of the exposure, whether if it's, the children that you come across that have died in various ways, or an officer involved shooting, or suicides is a big one for some cops. Like, they don't like hangings. They don't like, they struggle with, there's so many different aspects of police work and stuff that you see that, it affects everybody differently.
You sure does.
And going back to the agencies, you mentioned, a friend of yours that was over at Sandy, and you're at West Valley, and you're like, I saw this much in 3 months. They didn't see anything. And that's very, very true. I remember when I was at, I came across an officer over at Salt Lake, and he had been at Salt Lake Police Department for, I think, 7 or 8 years, and the guy had never been on a homicide scene. And I was like, what?
No kidding.
And so,
No
yeah,
kidding.
so it's even your big metropolitan police departments, even all the way down to your small departments, say, we'll say Vernal Police Department, right? No reason for saying Vernal, but just because they're small. And then you've got West Valley, and you've got South Jordan, and the officers are going to experience different things in all of those different agencies, and the frequency is going to be different in all of those agencies as well. And yeah,
Absolutely.
and so, I think that's where this whole EAP or EAP thing comes from, is that it's just an easy blanket across the board for these municipal agencies and these county agencies. Now, the one agency that I've got to give kudos to is the Utah State Attorney General's office, specifically the ICAC unit. So when I was in the ICAC unit, which is Internet Crimes Against Children, and I did that assignment for maybe a year, I think probably less than a year, and I threw in my hat, man. I ended up, yeah,
Really?
dude. I worked a variety of different assignments, and I really wanted to work that assignment when a friend of ours was over there, Eric Anderson. He worked it for a little while, and anyways,
Right.
I really wanted to work that assignment. I finally got the opportunity to, and I ended up with a video image of an adult and an infant, and it had audio. And I'll tell you, I couldn't finish watching it. And two, it made me so angry, and there's no way I could do that. I'm like, there's no way I can do this. I went to my lieutenant, and I said, I'm done. I know it hasn't been 2 years, but there's no way I can do this. And
Yeah.
but the kudos to them was at about that time, the administration there had made a cognitive decision. They understood the trauma that the full-time agents were going through, being exposed to all of this horrific, horrific trauma, like all these acts committed by adults on children, just sick, right? And they seeked out three psychologists, and they actually went to the full-time agents and said, okay, here's three psychologists that we've identified. And the agents actually sat down and basically interviewed all three of them, and the team decided which psychologist they wanted. And the attorney general's office paid for it. And now there was a psychologist available to these agents 24/7. And they also received reviews, I think they were going on once a year. So they would get a review once a year, every 6 months, but they also had access to this professional 24/7. And I thought to myself, that is the coolest thing that a department's ever done for these officers. And that should be done for every police department across this country. And I understand that,
Absolutely.
some of these agencies, they don't have as much going on, but at least make it available.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's with my personal situation, I personally, individually, and my wife and I, we both went to EAP several times. And nobody could diagnose what I had, right? And it seemed like everybody wanted to blow smoke up my ass. They tried to relate, but they really couldn't. I found myself just kind of laughing at some of their responses because they weren't real life responses. And skip ahead. I've retired early. I've divorced. I've talked to a couple of buddies from PD days, and they said, "Hey, go to this guy." So I go to this guy, and I'm sitting there. I'm looking at this guy. He's in a sweater, nerdy glasses on. He's got a BYU graduation certificate behind him, and I'm thinking, "Oh my God, this is going to be another EAP counselor." And I listened to his spiel a little bit, and he listened to me, and he says, "Well, do you have any questions?" I said, "Well, to be honest with you, I sat down with six or seven people like you, and the reality of it is they haven't done any." And he stopped me. He says, "Let me finish that for you. You sat down with six or seven people from your EAP program." You still there, buddy? Okay. You sat down with six or seven people from EAP, and you couldn't relate to them. They couldn't relate to you. And so you didn't get anything out of it. And you're thinking that I'm going to be the same way as they were, and that you're not going to get anything out of it, right? And I said, "Absolutely." And he leaned forward in his chair, and here's his BYU graduate. He leans forward in his chair, and he says, "Totally understand. And we got a lot of fucking work to do. So you want to keep complaining about it, or do you want to get to work?"
Nice.
And I looked at that guy and I went, "I just found him.
Yep.
This is my ticket." And 3 appointments later, he had helped me compartmentalize stuff. Sure, Ellis, those things still come up and you still think about those things. The reality of it is, though, is if you get somebody that is professional and understands how to deal with the trauma and how to teach you how to deal with the trauma, then you can compartmentalize that trauma and only bring it up when you have to bring it up. And that's what lends itself to healing. And when there's healing within everything else, your relationships, the relationship with your kids, your spouse, with other people. And it was a learning lesson for me, but you're absolutely right. Every department needs to have something like that, and they don't. I don't know if it's a money thing. I don't understand that part of it. All I know is that it's so simple to take that step of having somebody there available. And it's even simpler to keep people from hurting themselves or killing themselves as a result of it.
I think it is. I mean, I don't know. I hate to say that it's money. I mean, I've never worked as an administrator with an agency. I don't think it's money. I think they could put money off to the side for situations and to secure a really good professional and make them available. But, I don't know. That's a good question. You don't know if it's because it's something they want to avoid or they think it's, who knows? Who knows? It's crazy. It's at the end of the day, it's crazy. And we have to take care of ourselves. We've got to be able to recognize what we're experiencing and the effect that it's having on us. And we've got to be the ones to kind of seek it down. And I think that's also where our peers can, be beneficial, such as yourself, where you've had this great experience with this professional and you can provide, a referral, right? And say, hey, look, go see this guy. And that guy might work for one or two of the referrals and maybe not the other. You've got to really connect
Correct.
With the person that you're seeing and have that relationship. That's what makes it work. But definitely
well,
talking about it with a therapist and discussing it is that's part of healing, like you mentioned.
I think that is a necessary step, but I think, I think that you and I need to take it a little bit further. And, how many times have we heard, whether it's in law enforcement or just, handling calls, we have a brother that you and I can both say that everybody looks around and says, oh man, I didn't know that he was sad. I didn't know that he was having problems.
Yeah.
And I really think that as individuals, we need to look at the person to our left and look to the person to our right and say, hey, man, what can I do to help you? I'm here. I'm not going to leave it at, hey, do you need help? If you need help, get a hold of me. It's like, brother, I'm here. What do you need?
Yep.
And be willing as human beings to say, Ellis, I totally can understand what you're going through. And I'm going to help you out any way that I can. So what do you need from me? We need to be willing to have that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And taking it home and trying to drink it away or taking drugs or prescriptions, it doesn't help. All it does is just kind of suppress it, and you're going to continue to deal with it. And then eventually it's going to have an impact, a negative impact on your career and your family, like you mentioned, right?
Absolutely.
It's crazy. And, the other thing, too, is I think, let's go back to this 3-year-old in the car. Or wait, yeah, the 3-year-old in the car. Where was you at on your work week there? Was it at the end of, towards the end of the work week, middle, the beginning?
It was right at the end.
Right at the end. So you're off for 3 days and back to work.
Yeah.
And you go back to work.
Yeah.
You're clearly still dealing with this. Did anybody from the agency be like, hey, how you doing from this? Or, is there something we can do to get you help?
Not at all.
And that's the problem.
And that is the problem. That is the problem. Now, I'll tell you the thing that did happen, and these people are awesome. I love them. They're incredible people. Two officers, one of my sisters in blue and one of my brothers in blue. Both of them came to me. In fact, they came to me 2 years after and said, hey, just checking in on you, making sure that you're okay. In a lot of ways, I think that they helped me get further than I could have had they not been there. And they were willing to have that conversation. But the department was, hey, this is just another call. You just have to go and deal with it and then go back to work.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it makes it tough. It makes it tough, especially when you're going from call to call to call and you're busy and you've got to, yeah, it's just, it's nuts, man. And to make it a 20-year career, being exposed to all of this different trauma, whether if it's a horrific traffic accident or an infant that dies of SIDS or drowning, or you're involved in a shooting, or you go on a domestic and the other party was just nearly beaten to death but they're still alive. I mean, there's just such a huge number of different horrific acts that you see over the course of your career, and it's just nuts, man. I mean, to make it like you can go work for a smaller agency, be exposed to some minimal stuff, and still be fucked up from it. It
Oh,
depends on
absolutely.
what it is that you're exposed to, and how you deal with it, and how it has an effect on you, man. And that's I think that's what people think the administration or the society or community, it's like we're robots. We go, like you mentioned earlier, you get to hold up this warrior stigma, and that's all fine and dandy, but at the end of the day, man, we're still people. And
Yeah, we're still human.
and these people, like for everybody else, even the administration, even they're not exposed to as much of all of this either. They're not, even if, like, I mean, I can count on one hand how many administrators was on the road for less than 5 years. Next thing you know, they're promoted and now they're a lieutenant or something. They weren't exposed to half the shit.
Right. That's and yeah, you hit it right on the head there. They're dealing with their own situation, and like you said, they may not have dealt with anything similar to what this particular officer is having a problem with, and so they may not be able to relate as well. I was listening to your last podcast, and hanging deaths, they didn't really bother me that much. But as a human, you have to be able to look at that and say, how can you not look at that and say, hey, brother, I understand that you're having a challenge with this hanging death because I'm having a challenge with a 2-year-old kid that passed out on the back seat of a car and passed away. I'm still hanging on to that. So I understand. What can I do for you?
Yeah, there you go. Very true. Let's take a break, man, and then we'll
All right.
come back and on a positive note.
Yeah, let's do it.
That all of that was really good stuff, and I appreciate you, Mike, sharing some of those details with us. And I think it's important. I think it's important. I mean, obviously, there's cops that listen to this podcast, and in addition to the community, so. And hopefully there'll be some administrators in a police department that listens to it and goes, maybe we ought to do something.
I agree.
But to let the society know as well is, it's not always like sad and traumatic like what we've discussed. I mean, that was just a couple of events in 10 years. I mean, one of my favorite assignments that I worked was working in the schools and being a SRO over at Granger. I mean, I loved being there for those kids and giving them the support and the direction they needed, and it was like super rewarding. It was probably the most rewarding assignment. Like, I really digged it, loved it.
I always wanted to go into the schools, and it just didn't work out for me. I think the closest thing was COP for me, community policing, and I
Yeah.
love that assignment.
Yeah. But I mean, working police work in general, I mean, I don't know what the percentage is. I haven't thought about it in quite a while, but there's some moments during police work, whether, depending on the call you go on. There's some moments there that are like, okay, this is cool. This is why I got in and do this job. So,
Absolutely.
but yeah, man. The other one was that I really enjoyed and that was super rewarding was the work in child sex offenses. It was challenging, but it was rewarding because I was kind of the voice for these kids, these young kids. And so
Sure.
that's where the positive came from that assignment was, being able to put together a really awesome investigation and a report and be the voice for the victim and get these guys or gals, whoever the perp was, get them convicted. So there's positives in all of it, and then there's a lot of negatives, and that's where government fails is not taking care of these guys, making sure they have the assistance they need.
No, I agree.
But then there's the funny aspects of police work, and that we sit back and we laugh and we're just like, what the hell, right? I mean,
Right.
scenes we go on or calls we go on or whatever. You got anything that's pretty funny that you remember from your 10 years?
The time I shot a desk.
Shut up. You shot a
Did you ever
desk?
hear about that?
I don't know.
Well, yeah. So I'm pretty notorious for that. So I'm on the firearm staff teaching the department how to shoot and how to be safe with their gun. I get called over to a shoplifting call over at a grocery store there in West Valley and get there. The kid's handcuffed. He wasn't handcuffed. He was just sitting there with his hands in his lap, book a backpack underneath his chair, and he'd been stealing stuff. And the store personnel said that he had more stuff in the backpack. So I grabbed the backpack, and I had picked him up, just searched, patted him down real quick, and grabbed his backpack. And as I'm opening it up, I said, "Is there anything in here that I need to know about?" He says, "Well, there's a gun." And so I scooped him up. I handcuffed him and opened up the backpack, and there's a bunch of stolen property and a case, and it has a gun in it. And open up the case, gun sitting there. I got two magazines outside of the gun, and I looked and looked to see if there's a magazine. There's a black hole, and go to eject any round that might be in the barrel, and rack the slide back. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm heck. I'm on the firearm staff. Rack
Right.
the slide back, and round comes flying out of the barrel, and slide goes back, and the hammer stays back. And I'm thinking, man, this ain't right. This picture ain't right. The slide should be locked back. And there's no decock lever on the gun. No decock lever on the gun. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, hell, just kind of a split second. How the hell do I get this hammer down without pulling the trigger? I look at him because it's his gun. I says, "Hey, how do you get the hammer down without pulling the trigger? There's no decock lever on this." And he says, "Well, the only way that you can do it is pull the trigger, I guess." So I pointed
Oh
it.
no.
No, seriously. And so I pointed it at a desk. It was a steel backed desk, and it had a two brick cinder wall but between the desk and the outside world. Pointed it at the desk and pulled the trigger, and boom! Yeah. So the round goes through the top of the desk, it hits the steel back, and it bounces, and it hits me in the boot, and the bullet's sitting right there at my foot, right? Smoke all over the place. I got people running in from the grocery store to find out who just got shot. I'm realizing at this point how stupid I was for doing what I did. What happened was is the black that I saw where the magazine was sitting the gun, that was actually a black magazine. And when I did the release, it didn't drop out. I looked at it, and it's like a black hole. I got the two magazines that are both chrome sitting in the case. Hell, I just thought that the magazine was gone, just one of those not paying attention type of moments. Well, we had an acting sergeant that day, and he and I had been talking, and he was like, just I'm hoping that nobody gets into some into shit today. And here I am. I'm having to call him on channel two and saying, "Hey, get to the grocery store. I just had an AD." And so he gets there. He's like, "Are you kidding?" I was like, "Nope." And so what was funny, though, was as I was working at this grocery store doing part-time security on the side. Mm-hmm. And I had actually left about 2 weeks before. And so I knew everybody there. I knew the security there. I knew all the employees there. And so I get this. I go into work one time right before Christmas that year, about 4 or 5 months later. And, you know, if you remember, we had the mailboxes right there when you walked in.
Yeah.
So I walk up to my desk to see if there's any paperwork in there, and I've got a Christmas card. And I still have the Christmas card. It's just in my book of memories. But I open it up, and I read it. It's a beautiful, beautiful Christmas card. And inside it's written, "From all of us at Harmon's, we miss you. We're glad you missed us." I died. It was the funniest moment. But yeah, that was notorious. They're on the firearm staff every time that I would go up and do qualifying shoots. I would have a picture of the desk on my target.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. I don't believe I ever heard that story.
Really? That's funny. World, yeah. How's that?
That is crazy. Oh my gosh. I'm like, oh, I can only imagine what's going through your mind after that gun went off. Oh my gosh.
It was hilarious. It was hilarious.
I did kind of the similar, I mean, nothing similar, but. Well, kind of. So I bought this, it was a baby Glock, a new baby Glock. And I know my buddy that he should probably be listening to this podcast, but we stopped over at my house and I showed him this gun and we're standing in the kitchen, right? So I take the magazine out and I clear it. And I make sure the weapon's completely clear, right? And I hand it to him. And he takes a look at it. And he's like, "Yeah, this is a really nice gun." I was like, "Yeah, man, it shoots really nice too, you know, considering like how small it was." And he hands me back the gun. And I take and I throw a magazine in and I rack around and I point it. And there's this freaking Oreo box, you know, the Oreo symbol guy, just off by the back door for some, like, you know, recycled trash to go outside.
Right.
And I point the weapon at this Oreo guy on this Oreo box, and I'm pointing, and I fire. And I shot it, man. And that gun went off, and we're in the kitchen, and it was so loud, and like you said, yep, smoke everywhere. And I was just like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, like, "Holy shit, what just happened?"
I hurry up and I clear the weapon. And I look at him. I said, "Dude, what the fuck?" And he goes, "That's what I was thinking." He goes, "You put that magazine in and racked around, and then you were pointing it at the garbage." I was thinking to myself, "What the hell's he doing?" I'm like, "I don't even know what the fuck I was thinking."
moments of sheer stupidity that have turned out successful instead of traumatic. How's that?
Right. Oh my gosh, dude. I was like, "What in the hell? What was I thinking?" Right. I mean, because I remember putting the magazine in, racking it, and I'm like, "Why would I shoot it?" And yeah, it was nuts, man. I hurried up. I turned my radio on. I'm like, "Dude, I go outside, make sure it didn't exit the house," which it didn't, thank God, because I had brick on the outside. And, yeah, I'm listening, making sure there's not a call that comes into dispatch for shots fired.
That's
in the neighborhood when I was living over there off of Lorna.
That's funny. That's funny.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's, you know, for me, it was, you know, it was a real good, humble experience because, you know, you get out on the line and you're training people and you see some stupid things. And then you think to yourself, I can't be as critical about these stupid things. I have to be an instructor and be humble about this because I did something really stupid.
Yeah, no, it definitely humbles you. I mean, my situation was a little more contained. I mean, it was in my kitchen with a buddy. It wasn't at a grocery store. Oh shit, that's funny, man.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
good times anyways, that's for sure. What's well, that's awesome, man. I appreciate you coming on board with this and chatting with us. This is super cool. What's do you, if somebody was to come to you right now and is like, hey, I want to go into police work, what direction or advice would you give them for their career?
boy, I wasn't ready for that one, dude.
I know. I always like kind of throw that one out there at the last.
It's hard because, when I got on 94, we had a couple of old timers that I was eating dinner with one night, and they were saying, man, if I would have gotten into law enforcement now, I would never have gotten into law enforcement. And I truly felt that they were just old and cynical, and they were ready to retire. And I was gung ho and excited, and then you flip ahead 10 years, the different cases, the different administrative BS, just life in general changes how you look at things, and certainly the last. Not bringing up politics or anything, but I think that there's been a huge media vilification of law enforcement over the last 3 to 4 years that, is really bearing down on cops. Let alone the different types of crimes and the drugs that are involved in it now. Different levels of respect for law enforcement or lack of respect. I've got a good buddy of mine that is now working for that same agency you and I were for. And, when he came to me, he says, hey, I understand that you work for West Valley. And I'm looking at being a cop. The first thing I told him was, it is a damn good honorable profession, and you'll have a lot of fun doing it. I said, just put safeguards in place. You're feeling like shit emotionally, mentally. You need to search out help. Just be safe with it. And, you know, and the reality of it is take it as it is. You're dealing with 90%. 90% of the people that you don't deal with are the good people. 10% are the bad people, and you spend up most of your time dealing with them. And don't get sucked up into that. I think that's COP really opened my eyes to that, and it was really nice to work with the community and get to know people face to face within that neighborhood. Bring that sense of reality back, and so you just, I think guys and men and women that are getting into law enforcement today just need to have that realistic expectation that it's not NCIS or Chicago PD. It is something that you can have a lot of fun, a lot of reward, and at the same time, there is inherent risk with the job, and you need to put safeguards in place, not only keeping yourself fit physically, but emotionally and mentally, and do whatever you can to not bring that shit home, but also not be so damn proud or so damn scared of an image of going and seeking help when you truly need help.
Yeah, no, good call, man. I totally concur with that. Absolutely. Well, right on, man. Is there anything else you want to share with us?
No, man, I was just trying to give you that Joe Rogan experience that you were trying to get. So
What's that?
it's just going back and forth and having fun. And I think with all the podcasts, it's been awesome listening to. And like I was telling you the other night, I think that these podcasts are for me, they've been extremely helpful, but they're also fun because I can remember and just be a part of that. And for the community outside that doesn't know law enforcement as much, we are humans, and and they get to see that through these podcasts. I think that you're doing a great service, brother. And, you know, I just respect you. I always have. I respect you. I appreciate you. And
oh, thank you, man.
Just keep it up, brother.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you. And no, I respect you too, man. I mean, I appreciate you coming on and sharing this. And yeah, I hope that you know, this podcast is beneficial for everybody listening, you know, the community listening, as well as other officers and the ones that come on. It's beneficial for them. So that's kind of the purpose. And yeah, the Joe Rogan Experience. I tell you, like, I never ever listened to podcasts before. Never. I would much rather listen to music, right?
Yeah.
And you know, and then this Cold podcast came out, and they were asking me, hey, will you be on this? And I put them off for a little while. I was like, yeah, I don't know. And then finally I just decided, heck, I just as well do it, right?
Yeah.
And it was super, super therapeutic, and I did it. And obviously I wanted to listen to it to see how they were pitching it. And that's about the extent of my listening to podcasts. And then a good friend of mine hit me up. And he's like, hey, you need to listen to this podcast. And it was Tim Ferriss and Tony Robbins. Never heard of either one of these guys. I've heard of Tony Robbins, but I didn't know what he was about.
Right.
And I listened to that podcast, and I fell in love with Tony Robbins. I'm like, this guy is legit. Like, he is says it how it is. And I loved it, right? And right. So then the next one that was suggested by the same person was suggested listening to Joe Rogan. And I was like, oh, okay. So I got on, and man, that guy's got freaking 1200, 1300 freaking episodes. And so it's like,
yeah,
half the people he brings on his show I've never heard of. So it's just a matter of picking one that you want to listen to a topic. And I listened to his, and you know, he does his all live, not editing. And they just kind of talk about a variety of different topics and go back and forth. And there's nothing political about it, or, you know, I mean, they're just talking like how we've been doing. And I was like, I dig that. Like, I dig it. I respect it. It's, you know, there's nothing edited out of it. And, you know, I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And so I was like, you know, that's kind of how I wanted to run this, and just let it go, and it goes wherever. And, yes, I hope people like it. I need to somehow get a hold of Joe Rogan and be like, dude, you need to have me on your podcast, man. Because I think we would have a good time. And, you know, we could have the listeners, they could tally how many times, who says fuck more. I try to refrain too much on my podcast, you know, but if I was on his, dude, it would be game on, man. I'd be like, all right, Joe, this is the plan, dude.
Well, shit, he's like high half the time, so it's pretty funny. But you know, I love that whole, you know, interacting, just having a conversation, because I really think that you can get really, you can really get scripted. Not you, but just people in general, you can get really scripted on a podcast, and to be able to just have a conversation, that's where you learn things.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where you can take things that you hear and apply it to your life. And you know, like with every one of the 1088s, I've learned something from every one of them.
Yeah.
And I love that, because it is a conversation. It's like, you know, the cool thing is, you know, without seeing somebody face to face, you feel like you're in the room having a conversation with somebody over a cup of coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. So, I don't know, man. I like it. I think it's cool. It actually takes up a little bit more time than what I expected. I didn't think it'd really take up. Yeah. Cause you kind of like, I'll kind of prep. I try to prep a little bit before, you know, and obviously we've talked a couple of times, and so you kind of want to be on the same sheet of music with your guests that's coming on. And, you know, because I don't want to ask, you know, questions that, you know, that you don't want to answer. Right. Be like, oh,
sure.
You know, but For anybody else out there that's listening, and if you're a cop and you're going to come on the podcast, if I do ask you a question, you don't want to answer it, just fucking tell me. It's like, yeah, I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, cool. Let's move on, man. No hard feelings, right?
Exactly. No, I think it's great. I think, like I said, I'm excited for you doing these, and I'm excited for anybody that gets to listen to them.
Right
So.
on, brother. All right, man. Well, have yourself an awesome weekend, and appreciate you coming on board, man. Take care.
You too, brother. Bring some warm weather back from Tucson, even though you're back already. Bring it, because I need to do brakes on my car.
Yeah, no doubt. I agree with you on that, man. I got to get out of here and go somewhere warm. I don't like this. All right. Have a good one, man. Take care.
You too, dude. Take care.
Wow. What a stud. For Mike to come out and discuss these events that were troubling him is so tough and super remarkable. Kudos for him. Hopefully his story inspires others. I'm so proud of the progress that he has made over the years. Before we wrap up, let me tell you, Shield Balance LLC is a private investigation agency. We do investigative work, consulting, and training. If you are engaged in a relationship and this relationship may get more involved, consider contracting with Shield Balance. We can complete a full background on this partner. You may think you know them, but do you really? Also, same thing goes. We can do complete backgrounds on future business partners as well as pre-employment backgrounds. So contact us now at shieldbalance.com or 833-745-3225. Again, 833-745-3225 or at shieldbalance.com. Have a great work week. And again, thank you for listening. Be safe.